When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Saving money on everything for your next project at Menards. It doesn't matter what job you're up against. Works cordless power tools and lawn equipment have the power for you to get the job done faster and easier. The PowerShare 20-volt batteries run longer on a single charge, and they can be used with other tools. Check out Menards' entire selection of Works cordless power tools and lawn equipment. Plus the weekly flyer today on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys will rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take me out.
Give me all you got!
Vincent.
Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Today, I'm talking to a man who last spoke to me on the two-part finale episode of One Heat Minute, a recovering journalist, a 90s nostalgist, a legend, and a friend, the great Chris Tapley. Chris, thank you so much for coming back, starting this old behemoth up that's had a tarp on it in the garage, One Heat Minute, and coming back to talk to me about the release, because today, internationally, is the release day of Michael Mann and Meg Gardner's Heat 2 novel. And I've talked to many times in like a bunch of different ways that we're going to unpack the novel in the six parts, over the six parts of the book that happened, talking through it, deep diving, a bit of a Heat 2 book club. But I wanted to kind of give an overview and a bit of a review of the book out there, because lots of people are excited about it. Lots of people want to hear, is it worth the read? Is it good? Is it, you know, Heat is a sacred text to people like Chris and I. So it's like, is this thing going to be good? Am I freaking out about it? Chris, first up, were you excited when you heard the prospect of a Heat 2 book?
No. First of all, let me say thanks for having me back. Always a pleasure to talk about Heat with anybody, and especially you. So this is awesome. No, I was not excited. I was terrified.
Yeah.
I was terrified. How can you not be? I mean, I thought, why? I thought, I know Michael Mann knows every one of these characters so thoroughly that he could give us a 500 to 1,000 page book on each of them. So it's not like I didn't think it wouldn't be thorough or even necessarily like worthy of him, obviously, but just it's the kind of thing where when you go further than the thing, when you branch out from the document, and you just cover the minutiae that sort of informs the document more and more, does it lessen the impact of the document, right? It's what's happening to me, like with Star Wars and stuff. Like, the more we explain this one little thing that happened in this one movie or whatever.
Or one character who was in the background at a cantina.
You know about that guy.
You're like, do I really need to know about this guy?
It's like, yeah, you can do that. You can obsessively just keep peeling back the layers, but will it lessen the thing? And that was sort of my fear. All the way up until the moment I cracked the thing open and started reading it. I was just like, okay, here we go. Is everybody, because at that point I heard some praise, obviously, and I was like, are they in the tank? You know, whatever. We'll see. And even just the fact that it was called Heat 2.
Yeah.
There's no subtitle or anything. It's just Heat 2. I'm like, oh, man, please don't be bad. It was never going to be bad, though. It kicked ass, but we'll get into that.
Yeah.
I was not excited, but I was curious is the right word.
Thank God when I was in New York for the Heat 4K, which is now also out at Best Buy, you can pick it up in the States, do that. And it's going to be more widely available all over the place. Thanks to Jen Johans for securing me the Steelbook edition of that beautiful Heat 4K. But at the screening, they just put a pile of what's called galleys. If you don't know what that means, galleys is like the shorthand term for like a paperback version of the review copies of the book that they cycle out, an advanced reader's edition they send out to a whole bunch of reviewers or people who, you know, are friends of man and friends of or, you know, people who've probably been involved in the project, etc. But they just put a big pile of them out there. And I remember being there, and when I was backstage in the green room, I asked if I could get my hands on one. And the pile, this gigantic mountainous pile of advanced reader copies, as you would expect at a frothy Heat anniversary screening, just snatched them up. And so fortunately, one of our friends, a hubby and wife partnership, they like Connor O'Donnell and his wife, they had a copy each. And I walked out and she goes, "You didn't get a copy?" And I go, "No." And she goes, "Oh, no, just take mine. It's you. Like, what, you didn't get a copy?" I was like, "Thank you." So I've since pored over it. I was fearful, but way, way, way back, like if we're talking about like the evolution of Heat 2, on episode 162, Michael Mann's former writing partner for the Heat 2 novel, Reed Farrell Coleman, who's a New York Times bestselling crime author, he was part of the show. Like, he came on the show to talk to us. And so I'd kind of heard about it and percolating and how it was going to work and that it was going to happen in multiple time periods. And for anyone who's listening, kind of heard back then. So I was kind of excited about it. And when it kind of didn't come out then, that's when the fear started for me too. I was like, "Oh God, like what happened? What, they couldn't crack it." That was my biggest thing, is like they had the ideas, but they couldn't crack the story. But when I got my hands on it and I finally just sat down, the minute, the greatest benefit for any film book, and I think most recently people would have had perhaps this experience reading Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood novelization, is that all, so much of the hard work of visualizing who these characters are done. I've lived with them my entire life. The moment that Vincent Hanna starts speaking, in my mind is the movie playing of 95 Al Pacino just delivering dialogue, and it's Casals and it's Drucker, and it's like, and it's Val in my head is Chrisha Hillis, and I'm just like, "Oh, how, of course I'm going to love this." Like, it's like, it almost didn't matter at that moment. But obviously then I think that the further I dived into the story, and I think honestly, the latter half of the book, the escalation of that excitement and that action packed stuff and these, and the kind of the way that it renders these images that are so quintessentially Heat in your head, and the movie for me played out in my mind while I was reading it, I was just like, I was in a euphoric state towards the end of the book. I had such I had such an amazing time.
I flew through it too. 3 days, 3.5 days. I could not put it. I looked down and I had read 120 pages one day. I was like, "Oh my God." And it's because of that rhythm that, you know, the characters, like you can just blow through a couple of pages of a scene because it's in your blood. Like, you know this vibe, you know this world that he's created, you know these characters and their rhythms and what he established on film, you know, in 95. So it's like, yeah, it just comes second nature. And then the question is this going to work structurally? And what I took away from it, and first of all, you mentioned the galley. I got a galley too. I reached out to Michael's publicist. I was like, I got to read this. Can I please get a copy? And I've known her for a long time. She's a great friend, but she's like, "I have a galley," and she sent it to me. So I've been reading the galley as well. And this was at a time, I'm specifically talking about that because this was at a time when a lot of press were getting the completed hardcover. When you read a galley, sometimes there will be, well, often, usually, I feel like, I could be wrong, but I just feel like a lot of them I've read, there's like the little, "Oh, there's not a period, there's a period missing, there's a word misspelled." There wasn't a single fucking thing about this book that needed to be edited. It was ready to go, you know, hit the press for hardcover. It was that kind of struck me because I kept waiting for something like that, just some weird, like, "Oh, there's a mess up." Nope. And of course, he wasn't going to be that guy to have anything out of place. But what struck me about it, and what I said about it immediately when I finished reading it, was it was like I just got a chance to look, to just download Michael Mann's research.
Yeah.
And it had been structured in such a way, it was like reading a narrative dossier, yeah. You know, like a dossier of all, like I could, it's just so full of all the research he did in establishing these characters, and we all know about his process and how he just goes deep on backstory with his characters. And to see that in a document, it just felt special, because you never had a filmmaker do something like that, really. I mean, I can't think of anything like this where you're just given a front row seat to his brain on these characters that he's had in his head for decades. And that was what was so striking to me about it, just how complete it was.
Yeah, it's also the rhythm of this thing, the kind of first few parts. It's a 6-part novel. It takes place immediately preceding the events of the heist, because one of the main threads of the story is Chris Chehalis, because he's obviously the only member of the crew that gets away. We get to see the fallout a little bit behind what happens from the heist itself, and how Robbery Homicide are trying to tie up the loose ends and figure out what's going on and try and capture every member of the crew and try and figure out how they did it. And then it immediately sort of bounces into a couple of different time periods. 1988 is kind of where we start, and we end in 2000. In between, we bounce around to a few different locations. We pop into Southeast Asia temporarily. We pop out into South America, into Ciudad del Este, which people from Miami Vice fans out there, we've already been there. You've seen it lined with styrofoam empty boxes. You've seen Archangel De Jesus Montoya bargain with Sonny and Tubbs. So you've seen it. You've seen these sorts of places, and you sort of see this great straddling between this kind of cowboy version of crime and heist and robbery to this like transnational, dark web enabled new version of crime. And so we saw the natural evolution of it in some of his crime films, where you look at, like, you know, you're talking about Collateral, and then you, as an assassin who's hired by a cartel to come in and take out witnesses and lawyers in a case, and then you see it in Vice, you know, writ large, because you're in it, you're immersed in it. You see it in Black Hat, how people are messing with, you know, soy futures. So you kind of
there's a lot of Black Hat in this. I'm sorry to jump in, but yeah, there's a lot of Black Hat in it, which I actually kind of enjoyed.
Yeah, there is a lot of Black Hat, which I. But none of Chris Hemsworth's accent, which we can say is not in this book whatsoever. What I might do, I'll just quickly hit people with the plot that's on the back of the galley, and then I've got to tell you guys a little. You wouldn't be surprised a nerd like me would do something like this with the galley. I'll tell you this once I read the back of the book. So, Heat 2 starts one day after the events of the film. Chris Chehalis, wounded in a deadly heist, is desperate to escape L.A. The story moves between both the 6 years preceding the heist and the years immediately following it, featuring new characters, new worlds, high-end professional crime, with a cinematic action sequences. The venues range from the streets of LA to the inner sanctums of rival Taiwanese crime syndicates in South American free trade zone, to a massive drug cartel money laundering operation just over the border in Mexico, and eventually to Southeast Asia. Heat 2 explores the dangerous workings of international crime organizations with full-blooded portraits of its men and women. That is on the back of the book. I have completely destroyed my galley in the nicest way possible. I've what my friend delightfully coined coppering it, which is that I took this galley, I've torn it up, and I've now cut massive holes in several notebooks and started building exactly what Coppola did with The Godfather, which is like a notebook that I can write in the margins of, because I started writing on a few pages in the margins for notes for our more extensive deep dive on the book. We'll probably go about 6 episodes taking you through the different parts, but Chris and I are just giving you the high level kind of review today. But it is dense enough to do it. It's worthy of that. It has a lot of great allusions to his films, great allusions to music, like, you know, it discusses music that's sort of like in the story, and then funny little things and associations that happen with there. But what it ultimately has is just a phenomenal amount of stuff that when I was reading it, Chris, and I know you've read a ton of scripts too and written stuff like this, it's like when I was reading this, it was like a projector in the back of my head was going, the words that are on the page do not need to be here in a cinematic version of this. But when I'm reading it, it's like I'm cutting things away. I'm doing that thing that stripping these words away, stripping these things. And then it just feels like there's this living, breathing, you know, proof of concept for a movie that is in our head when you're reading this book. And I'm like,
totally.
I would totally watch this. I would totally be down for it.
It's very active.
Yes.
It just goes. So you're going to do 6 episodes, you said? So 6 parts. It's funny to me because like one of those parts is like, what, 10 pages long? I was like, why is this even a part? I thought that was interesting. I mean, I'm sure you'll get into that.
We'll dive into that.
But I just thought that was funny.
But then the last part, and I know that you said you read it in 3 days. I was similar. I read the whole thing. I was doing this thing. I was commuting to work. I was throwing on a Heat playlist, which has all the music from the film, and I was reading it. And it's only like a 35-minute train ride from my home station into town where I was going for work. And I was absolutely murdering that book. Like I did the same thing. I reckon it was like 3.5 days. And I was just reading it in my commutes because I was like, this is the perfect time. No other distractions, no other projects going on, no other anything. And it was only a couple of days, like a few commutes in, I was like doing, you know, about 120 pages a day. And it was like, and then that there was one last time where I got home from my commute. I did everything at home, family life, kids, et cetera, other podcasts. And then I just sat back down in my office chair and I just read the entire last, like whatever 200 pages I had. I just sat in my chair and read it. And it just escalated and sped up. And I think that if I was to talk about one thing that the book has to battle with is we do so much in like, the great text that is Heat, to wrangle all these characters together, to bring all these divergent storylines together, and then they come close to each other. And I think in some parts of the book, it's battling that resistance that you may naturally have for these people to move apart because you love the kinetic energy of as they're getting closer together, the stakes are higher. But one of the things I think the book manages so well is that they put these people in each other's orbit, and the closer they are together, the more this thing just absolutely explodes off the page. And so for me, I absolutely loved that aspect of it because happening over multiple time periods, not trying to retcon stuff, not trying to tell us really crazy new coincidences that are too much. You know, I feel like it's just right on the line of what you want to know these things, how you want to know these things are happening. But I just had such an amazing time. The first few chapters, these glimpses into the past feels definitely like man talking about, you know, these great crews, east coast to coast crews, crime crews that are thieves. Some of those people right out of Thief, you know, it feels like right out of a Thief crew in the late 80s. And then you move into...
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Contemporary crime and the bridge of these two things, I think it works so beautifully.
Yeah, I think I said something like, there's nothing forced about it. Like, it's electric, it vibrates, and it's not manipulated really into that place. It's really just a result of a guy that knows A, the people he's writing about, B, the world they come from, and this is obviously so much of it is additive too, because yeah, he's got all the research he put into developing these characters way back when, but he's pushing them forward into new worlds and new kind of crimescapes. And so it's full of all the research he's done basically since he made Heat. You know what I mean? Like all of that is a part of the fabric too. And it just becomes so effortless. It's the shit, man.
It rules. It really rules. Now, This is the real question. who the hell could possibly... So at the beginning of this, obviously there was a lot of news, which again, I'll reiterate, was a massive troll to the audience and then to the media, that Pacino was like, it should be Chalamet that plays Vincent Hanna. And,
no.
And Harry Styles to play Bob was his joke. If you don't get that, that's a joke, I can't help you. The one person that I think has been completely dismissed and wrongly is, who the hell is hot enough and dangerous enough to play Val Kilmer? Who in the planet is that kind of guy? Because like,
well,
he's
sorry,
the character in the book, where he goes, this intuition that he has, all these lessons that he's grown up with Neil, you sort of see him break away and take the you know, man describes Neil as this like, you know, Neil is a classicist and Chris is a postmodernist, like very intuitive, you know, adaptable. But I just was watching him, you know, in my head, it was playing as Val, this young Val. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God, if this thing ever does get made into a movie, who the hell plays Christian Ellis? It's a fucking tough hang.
I have an idea, and I don't know how this would be received given our joke a moment ago. I feel like it kind of can't be anybody but Chris Hemsworth. I mean, he's got the look. He's obviously worked with Michael. I could see him very much, again, under the wing of Michael Mann.
He doesn't need the size really well. He doesn't need the size. He needs to go back to his
he can drop that down. Yeah.
Because he's a super lean, muscular guy. But that was the thing that struck me. Is like, he's a guy that when he takes off all his hair, he's still like striking. But yeah, he totally, you know, I don't hate that. I don't hate that at all. I was going for like, because I'm such a big fan of him, I think like Taylor Kitsch has got a touch of the young Chris Chehalis. I was just trying to think 50s, 40s and 50s. Who's in that pocket where you can believe that they're that? But maybe Hemsworth is closer to that. I don't know. Like, I was just thinking like Kitsch, someone who's dangerous, unpredictable, can sort of say a lot without saying so much. But yeah, it's a tough hang when you start thinking about it. The only thing I'm saying, and with the greatest respect to things like The Irishman, I just do not want to see digitally de-aged Vincent Hanna. I don't think digitally de-aged De Niro. I do not think you can actually do this movie if you were doing it as a digital thing. I think you need to liberate the movie by allowing other people to play these great characters. And even if you pluck them off a Washington stage like Robert Prosky in Thief, like you need to find guys who can do a version of these roles that aren't slavishly wed to the movie in some ways, because you know you have to have the Stones Coppola style to go like, yes, we can cast a younger actor to play Marlon Brando, like we can. They don't have to be exactly the same, they don't have to look exactly the same, they just have to have the essence of that.
What makes it so tricky is the stuff after the movie.
Yes,
I mean, you know, five years after the events of the movie, you're gonna want them to look like what you just saw, but that's tricky.
It's so hard.
I don't imagine Michael would ever do a performance capture thing, visual effects deal. I don't know. Maybe he would.
So
he's working with Adam Driver now. I feel like Adam would be.
Adam can do anything. Literally,
I feel like he could find his way into that. Yeah, like, and you got to be up for it too. That's the other big element here. If you're gonna make a Michael Mann movie, you got to be up for it. And that's not every actor, I think, that could survive what you have to do to work in a Michael Mann movie. Like the headspace you have to occupy, and just the commitment, you know.
Yeah, that's why they are a tough hang for the actors. And it's like, even someone was like, I was thinking about Donnie Brasco, and I was like, oh, maybe Colin. Like, Colin could jump in there as a Vincent Hanna. I could totally see Colin Farrell as Vincent Hanna. I could see that. But again, I'm going to the pool of, I know these actors have all worked with Michael before, and they'd be down. Like, he'd make them go live in Chicago for 7 months and work in the IUD, whatever, the ICD,
look,
those kind of things.
I think Colin Farrell would be a good young Neil.
Yeah, both.
I mean, because he's basically doing De Niro in The Batman. I mean, that's like his penguin is like got some De Niro going on there, right? So like, I think the point is he can clearly tap into that.
Yeah.
And he's very, he's chameleonic in a way. So I think that could be cool. Who gets the, I think they should just cast, oh fuck. Chirito.
Who's our young Tom Sizemore? Who's our unpredictable?
Tom Sizemore. What my joke was, they should just cast Tom Sizemore. This guy was basically born with like 2 days of stubble on his chin. So he's always been this guy.
Tom, you need to.
I mean, if you can have Danny Trejo play Danny Trejo, why not just have Tom Sizemore back in the role, and he just never aged, or he's always been what he looks like.
So, without giving too much away in the spoiler territory, the 1988 segment of the film, the 1988 segment of the book takes place, and in and around this takes place with Neil's crew, who are a coast to coast crew. We start to see them doing jobs. We're seeing them work in multiple locations, scouting out things. We see relationships with characters that we already have established. If people were wondering what Neil's relationship is with people like Kelso, you'll find out what that happens. You'll find out, you'll get to see where Nate and Neil were at. We'll see how the crew was working across. We'll see different iterations of that crew and how that's going. And then you also see Vincent. We'd always heard about Vincent being a Chicago detective. And I think a few of us had hypothesized, you know, we hear Nate say, this guy took down Frankie Under and his crew in Chicago, and he was a fucking maniac in the original Heat. And we're imagining perhaps we're seeing Vincent take these guys down. But it does introduce us to a whole other kind of metaphysical presence that is in this book. And I don't want to spoil anything for anyone, but there's just a presence in this book that starts to connect these different divergent crews together. And I have to say, one of the most heartwarming things for me in the entire book was, as we go back to 1988 and as we meet Vincent Hanna, we find out that he, working as one of the lead detectives in the Chicago division, basically where Charlie Adamson came out of, basically where Dennis Farina came out of before they became script consultants and some of the greatest actors working in American films. But also we get to see that a young Casals, so Wes Studi's great character, is in Chicago with Vincent and then makes the move to LA eventually to Robbery Homicide Division. So when I was seeing that come together, I was like, I love this. I love that Casals, this stoic guy who's always the straight man to Vincent's chaos, you know, playing with a gun while he's telling Hank Azaria that Ashley Judd has a great ass. I love that he was in the story for much longer. It was one of those things that was like, oh, this makes total sense. And I love that, like, he brought Casals with him because he's like his closest friend. And it's that great moment in the truck when you see the infrared of Neil's face and he looks around to Bosco and he looks around to Schwartz and they're both like, I don't know what to do. And he looks at Casals and Casals shakes his head like, no, don't take him. It's like, that gesture now has a decade of experience of those two guys working as partners that informs it. And that warms my heart because I've always thought, oh, well, they must have been partners for years. But it's like that detail is like, you can totally tell man is like, he looks around and when he's explained to Vincent why he listens to Casals, I'm sure on the day, man's like, well, you guys have been partners for 10 years. You worked in Chicago together. You took down big scores. And I just love that now we can know that as canon. It's a really fun, really fun part of the book for me.
He's got his back so thoroughly.
Yes.
You know, like their operation is so smooth. I love that element too. Yeah. It's just their partnership and how they are on the same page at every beat. I also loved, again, I don't want to spoil anything. I'll just say Fiji. The fact that there are things when you do stuff like this where you want to connect, you want some connective tissue with something that was profound in the thing that you're writing a sequel or a prequel to or whatever. And the way Mann does that in this book, it really did make me a little emotional.
Yeah.
I was like, it was profoundly done and it gives you a whole other layer of understanding Neil in the movie Heat. And I guess I'll just, at the risk of spoilers, I'll just leave it at that. But it's just, That's a trick. That's yeah. There's one thing to take all of your research and just say, okay, and then this connects to this. Look at this cute little bridge that I've made between these two things. But he does it in such a way that sheds light on the, you know, the film in new ways and deepens it. And I did not anticipate that. I did not anticipate a document that would make me love my favorite movie even more.
Also, some context about Chris and Charlene that I think had the same impact on me that what you're talking about with Neil.
Absolutely.
The getting to render
the fire.
The fire.
The fire between them is amazing, and it really carries into the new movie and just what their into the movie and what their relationship is in that movie. You know, it's a burned out relationship of a sort in the movie, and
because you can't burn the river.
Yeah, exactly.
And
it's good. It's good stuff.
And what would you say? It's so hard when people have been saying it's action packed, it's this and that. And that's one of the things where I'm like, oh, it's great action. And I'm like, yeah, look, there's great action in books. I'm not going to say that there's not great action. Cinema as a visual medium obviously has the luxury of, like, you know, you can render it in such a way that you're elevating it with writing and the scripting and the staging. And then you've got something that's a visual thing that's in front of you that can be visually impressive. And then you've got the music. And so you kind of got this huge cocktail of intoxicants that, like, I feel like, you know, in a book, it sometimes doesn't render unless you've got a very great visual imagination. But God damn it, there's a couple of action sequences and layered action sequences on top of each other, and especially, you know, sort of what is one of the centerpiece action pieces of the movie, and then and the climactic action piece in sort of the same structural way as Heat, that I was like utterly blown away by. It was incredibly tense. I felt like I was turning the pages like someone joke reading, you know, how they're like, shump, like reading, shump, and I'm just like turning, like I'm like, I was flying through it. I was
can't read it fast enough.
Couldn't. I was like reading everywhere, getting through. Has a couple of really amazing action sequences. Again, littered with all of the beautiful tradecraft that we love. But I will say, like, proper. I was so satisfied, and I'm not going to say anything about the ending. But I can't tell you how satisfied I was with the ending. I like, even the final sentence.
Like the last page, yeah.
Last page of the book. Like, everything that leads up to it. And then that last sentence, I was like, he did it. He did it.
Son of a bitch did it.
Like, he didn't. I don't know. I'm getting a little bit choked up thinking about it, but I'm just like, I can't believe that they stuck the landing.
You know, yeah. And props, by the way, props to Meg.
Meg Gardner helping.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what the roles were here. Obviously, the book reads like a Michael Mann document, but she had to have just a huge hand in making whatever this was that was in his head work as a piece of literary narrative fiction.
Yes,
and that's a whole trick, and so I just I wanted to make sure I said that. Props to her.
Yeah, because you can totally tell where there's like a stream of consciousness ideas from man. Like, he's just he's a living dossier of these characters, and he's like throwing these ideas into the page, and then the connective tissue and the structure and then the beats and then some of the more deep dive digressions into these different parts of the story. I could totally feel it's like, this is more languid fiction writing. This is where someone who has got a lot of, like, they're taking a detail and they're running with it. You could totally, there was a nice harmony, I think. I don't think it was like two different voices that were not complementary. I feel like it worked. I feel like it really worked. And massive props to Meg, because again, what a fucking daunting task. Whatever the writer is, it's like,
I'm terrified.
Here's Michael Mann, and arguably his most famous and fan frothing movie, like a true crime classic. He's coming back to revisit it. It has all these iconic characters, iconic lines, iconic beats, and I want you to help me craft it and put your name on it with me. It's like, Jesus, I don't want to be responsible for this in some ways.
And certainly the one that he cares the most about. So it's daunting. And I also wanted to say, you were talking about the action sequences, the big climactic sequence that you'll get into with your series. It takes place in Speed Country, man. That's right where the bus was doing its thing. I just want to say that as a speed guy as well, I just, had a big smile on my face during that whole chunk.
If you go back through Chris's wonderful Twitter, where he showcases his absolutely outstanding VHS collection, I'm sure you can see a recent viewing of Speed on VHS and some
chat. No doubt.
There, so that's a good one. See, that's why we'll dive in, because, and that's why I've dissected this book, because I think that I feel like there are some really fun things to talk about and fun influences and fun, the other thing is it feels deeply contemporary with, you know, man's kind of modern films, the Collaterals of the World and those things. It also has a tremendous amount of, you know, that anchoring in, you know, this physical filmmaking, this huge filmmaking. And what man has been sort of talking about is, like, if we're going to make this, it's going to be a gigantic movie. It has to be a gigantic movie. It's not a TV series, and it's not this. It's a gigantic movie that takes place over multiple time periods, and things are interweaving between those periods and playing out. So it's going to be so fascinating to see how they actually execute on that. But man, I had a terrific time reading it, and I'm really looking forward to seeing how he does it. And I feel like it's like this weird retroactive thing of, like, I'm going to tease that we're going to do a book. I know that no one's going to give me the money that I want to actually make the thing in the way that it needs to be made, but we'll write the book and we'll prove that it's an international bestseller and that it actually is really great. And then someone will hopefully give me money to make the thing.
Yeah. And by the way, it should be said, props to Mann's team and, you know, publicity team. Just the rollout of this thing has been an event.
Yes.
That it kind of needed to be, I guess. Yes. Otherwise, it's just like, oh, this thing comes out. You know, he had a CBS Sunday Morning piece the other day. I don't know what Don Winslow is getting paid on the side, but God bless you, because he is just every day got more love. And he writes about the world of this book very much, too, by the way. So it's a great spokesperson for the book, in a sense. But I've just been really impressed with the publicity rollout for this book. And so just hats off to that whole team.
Yeah, and getting it in the hands of, you know, sometimes you don't want the book to go to the normal channels necessarily. You want people who are fans to, like, get their hands on it, which is why I'm extremely glad, thanks to Mann's team, particularly Mann's publicist Mara, who's, you know, been his champion for many, many years.
She's done an incredible job with his career.
Yeah.
She's done an incredible job situating him.
She's an amazing person. And I'm so glad that I've gotten to interact with her over this time doing all of our crazy shows. But I've had such a fun time seeing it pop up in the hands of people that I want to see it in the hands of. You know, I'm really good friends with the author, Sean Cosby, who people would know as S.A. Cosby, you know, best-selling author of things like Razorblade Tears, Blacktop Wasteland. I've seen it in the hands of, you know, I was in New York with Jordan Harper, another terrific crime writer, Priscilla Page, who's a great internet presence and champion of these kind of things. Like, when you see it pop up in the hands of the people that you really want it, like, you want them to have it and they get it and they consume it and they enjoy it, I'm like, I couldn't wait for all of that. So, but I know that, you know, I promised Travis Woods in the 165th episode, one episode before I spoke to the man I'm speaking to today, back in July 2019, this is how long ago it was, that if there was ever I would bring
pre-COVID.
Pre-COVID, the before times. Before the dark times. I keep saying this, before the dark times, before the empire is basically what I keep saying in my head. I can't get that line out of my head. But I promised him I would come back. So again, I just want to thank Chris for coming on, because if you know how much Chris loves this and is such an aficionado and a, you know, a real curator of, like, some of the best, that last breath, I guess, of true classic blockbuster Hollywood filmmaking. And really the peak, I think, is the kind of 90s. But who knows it and loves this movie to death as much as Chris, and you know me, who has dedicated his life to this thing, for me to not be disappointed instantaneously with this kind of sacrilegious act of, like, having something else out there that is a companion to it, I was just so pleased and so thrilled that it was a shift of medium. I was so pleased with what I got to see deeper. And I feel like they really, you know, like you said, it's like everything that man has wanted to have out there in some way has helped him inform and craft this thing. All of the little vignettes and bits and pieces that you get to acknowledge throughout the way, I think it was really expansive and great. And man, just hearing these characters talk more in your head, like a lunatic playing Al Pacino in your brain, or Robert De Niro, or Christian Ellis, Val Kilmer, or Tom Sizemore, and you know the characters living and breathing in your mind as you're reading it, whether you're riding on your commute or whether you're reading it on your couch. And yeah, it was just such a thrill, and I had a really great time, and I want to thank you so much for coming on and have a little chat about it. But as I said, we're going to do a 6-part episode. I'm going to let Chris come back when we're in Speed Country to unpack some of that at some point. We can deep dive and get spoiler heavy and talk about the different things in the book, but we'll talk about that. We'll do our little 6-part mini series, and then we will we'll keep our modern man campfire stoked in Miami Nice with Katie Walsh and I as we keep moving on. But look, man, thank you so much for coming to chat to me. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, dude. So good.
Absolutely. And we didn't even talk about the villain of this book, by the way.
No, we're
saving. We'll save it, but
he's fantastic.
My God. True. Who did you picture the whole time? I have to be honest. I pictured Wangro the whole time. I just couldn't get that image out of my head.
So I had obviously had Wangro in my head. It's kind of impossible not to have him in your head. But the actor I had was Yorick Van Wagenen, who plays Niels, who's Liz Salander's guardian. He plays the bad guy in Black Hat, and he plays the abusive therapist. I had that guy in my head, just like the physicality of him. Because he was kind of grotesque.
Dragon tattoo guy.
So yeah, he's a phenomenal, and he plays the bad guy in Black Hat. And I had him in my mind because of just his physicality, the way that he's described. But yeah, there's a centralized villain, in much in the same way that Wangro has a presence, but in a way more pronounced, active. It's not this like metaphysical thing. It's literally a villain of the book, if you like. I've tried to stay away from it because it's so good. It completely.
We'll cut all this out if you have to.
No, we're not going to cut it out. We're just going to say there is a villain. It's not just showing, you know, that Vincent and Neil were secretly following each other in 1988 and some BS, right? Like it that would have been so trite and awful. And I won't mention the shows that have consistently done it recently. But I'll just say, yeah, there's a villain in this who I was just like, wow, whoever gets to play that is going to have an absolute ball. They're going to have a ball playing a true blue, ruthless psychopath.
Just a despicable son of a bitch.
An incredibly well-rendered, despicable son of a bitch in every way. Every room he's in, every outfit he wears, every action he takes, every turn of dialogue. Really well-rendered, awful, awful villain. Completely suitable and beautifully made for this canon. I loved it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for being a part of the show again, my friend. Always a pleasure to talk
to
you.
Yeah, dude.
Great to see you. You're one of my favorites.
You too. I can't.
Great for life.
and you as well. I can't wait to talk about this more with you. I was just earlier today interviewing Dennis Leary for something.
Yes.
That I'm writing. And it's an oral history about a movie from the 90s that will hopefully be out in December. But I was just like, give me the chronology here. Like, how did you get involved? And he was like, well, I took a meeting with Michael Mann about Heat. And of course, I was just like, tell me more. Now, I don't know. Is that news? Leary took a general meeting with Michael May. It ended up being a general meeting, he said, because like there was no way he could do the movie. And I was just like, I was locked in on this. Like suddenly what I was talking to Dennis Leary about did not matter. I wanted to just hear more about this. And he just loved Michael Mann, and Thief was like one of his favorite movies. And so he just took this meeting. And, but I never knew that. I never knew that Dennis had met with Michael Mann about one of the many parts that were open still at that time. And he, of course, would go on to work with De Niro, and Wag the Dog. And, when they were gearing up for that movie, or maybe it wasn't quite, they were gearing up yet. Like he had worked with Tribeca Films on something else. So like he was talking to De Niro at some point. He thought he was well done with the movie at that point. He's like, what you been up to? And De Niro's like, I'm still fucking shooting Heat. So Dennis was like, oh, maybe I could have done it after all, or squeezed it in, because of just man's process of just like, he'll keep pushing if he has to. And the schedule is what he wants it to be. But I just thought that was fascinating. I was like, man, imagine Dennis Leary somewhere in Heat. He would have fit.
He would have fit. He's got the face for it and the fucking attitude. At that time of his career too, he was like still like angry Dennis. There wasn't like more reflective Dennis. It was angry Dennis. You could totally yeah. slot him in. He was that would
no cure crazy. For cancer Dennis in 1995, alongside Hank Azaria and Henry Rollins. Perfect.
If you say those names, Henry Rollins, Hank Azaria, and Dennis Leary, it's like there's no beat. Like there's no. Not there's no one of these things is not like the other. It's like, no, it's perfect. What are you talking about?
It sounds like a Tonight Show roll call from like 1996 or something. Yeah, it's like tonight on the Tonight Show, we've got Dennis Leary and Henry Rollins.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I thought you'd love that.
I'm gonna tag that as the back of this episode and just call it a nice little bonus or something. That's so fantastic. You're the best. Love you, man. Thanks
man. For
doing this.
Talk love to you too. Talk to you soon.
Peace.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Get everything for your next project today at Menards and save big money. Right now, all stock outlets with USB ports are on sale. Ditch the need for bulky USB adapters. Upgrade your home with features like ultra-fast charging, allowing you to charge your smart devices up to 40% faster than standard USB outlets. Also, view our weekly flyer on Menards.com and check out all the great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.